Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and co-parents of all ages, this podcast is for you. Introducing in the center ring, the amicable divorce expert, Judith Weigel.
When I was with the circus, we had solo acts like the tightrope walker and lion trainer, and we had family acts like the flying trapeze and acrobatic act. In family law, I have a family of professionals who are lawyers, mediators, and therapists. We work together collaboratively, or we refer our clients to whomever we think will do the right job to get our clients through divorce as amicably as possible. The family of professionals we have on the show today were part of a presentation we gave to Southern California Mediation Association a couple months ago. The title was How Mediators and Therapists Can Work Together. I thought we could take this act on the road and give you a program titled Behind the Divorce Curtain, How Mediators and Therapists Work in the Field of Divorce. So here are my friends and colleagues that will be on this panel today. Victoria Goldfarb. Now, Victoria is an attorney, a mediator, and a therapist. So we're all afraid of her. She's the triple threat. Then we have Dr. Kathy Memel, who actually started out as a family law paralegal many, many years ago, and then switched to being a therapist, and she's been in practice 40 years. We have Michelle Hahn, who's been a therapist forever, and Michelle is going to enter the world of mediation very soon if she hasn't already. And then we have Marvin Whistler. So Marvin has been like me, a paralegal on steroids. We file for divorce, but I don't think Marvin does that anymore. But he's definitely a mediator like I am. So everybody, welcome. Thank you for joining us. This is where you all get to say, thank you, Judy.
Thank you, Judy.
Thank you, Judy. Axel. Good to be here, Judy.
Thank you so much for coming. All right. So divorce is hard. Divorce is hard on everyone. It's hard on the spouses, the children, and it's hard on the professionals who work with them. So I just kind of want to talk about the challenges we all have and how we provide our services to our clients and the listeners. And I guess this is more for the therapist, my first question, and that is, how do you prepare your clients for the legal divorce once you know divorce is imminent? And start with whomever you want. Maybe Victoria, Kathy.
Okay, I'll start. I always inform people about the divorce options. Oftentimes, they're not even aware that these exist. And even though we see this, the issue of divorce in movies and books and magazines, when people go through it themselves, they really don't understand all the options that are available. So they could sit, if they don't really have anything, they could sit down between themselves in the privacy of their home and decide how they wish to separate their assets and debts for themselves and their children. There's more to this, but I'm just going to give some brief topics. Another one is mediation. It's a cooperative rather than combative approach to settling disputes out of court. And as a couple, you can privately meet with a family law mediator and work through all aspects of the dissolution. In co-mediation, you can sit privately with a family law mediation attorney together with a psychotherapist and get the benefit of the legal as well as the psychological expertise. In collaborative law, each of you hire your own collaborative mediation attorney. Sorry, it's the gardener outside. I can't control that.
Thank you, Kathy, for putting a little homegrown energy into the
broadcast. I wanted you to make sure that I wasn't shaving my beard.
Okay.
That's what it is. So if needed, other experts such as divorce coaches, child development therapists, and accountants can join this process. This process is private and confidential. So in collaborative law, an agreement is signed by both parties and their attorneys stating that if your collaborative process fails, your collaborative attorneys can no longer represent you in litigation. So this is a great motivator to get this completed. It all gets completed in the end anyway. There's also litigation where each person has their own attorney, or you can hire your own private judge.
So, Kathy, I think you're the only one out of all of us who has worked in the collaborative divorce, collaborative law model. How do you like it?
Oh, I like it because everybody knows what everybody's saying. And if you're in a litigation, the lawyers say don't talk to each other, and only the lawyers will talk to each other. So in a collaborative case, everybody knows what everybody else is saying. There's full disclosure.
All right. So does everybody sit around this? Is everybody in one room sitting around the table discussing?
Yes.
That's interesting. Okay. That's cool. Do you wish there was more of that?
I think it's better. I really do.
Do you?
Yeah. It shortcuts everything because, when you're in a litigation process, one lawyer will start sending emails and documents to the other lawyer. It takes forever. And also, in the beginning, a lawyer will ask for a retainer. And sometimes it could be anywhere from $5,000 to $50,000. And that's really used up very, very quickly. So if you have somebody in mediation, they're in control of making decisions, and their lawyers can help them go through that process.
So it's not cheap doing the collaborative law process because you have all these professionals, but overall it fast tracks it a little more and maybe you still contain cost?
In the long run, it's actually cheaper, I think.
Is it?
Yes, because I've had couples come in and they said, no, we want to go to court. I explained what happens in court. And 2 years later, they came back and they were just drained and exhausted. And they said, you know what? We have each spent over $300,000 on this divorce. And now we're just drained and can't do this anymore. So let's settle. Within two sessions, they were done. But they didn't believe it in the beginning. So some people believe it. And they'll go through the mediation process, and others have to learn the hard way, and they go through the court system, which is exhausting and financially prohibitive.
Victoria, what do you think?
I also received a certification in the collaborative method. And I just want to clarify that though all of the group sessions happen in a group, the people get to meet individually with their lawyer, and when there are mental health coaches involved, which often there are, they get to meet individually with their mental health coach before the big group meeting. So there is, you know, you do have the ability to meet with your own team before the negotiation happens in, you know, in the public area.
Victoria, so for the disclosure exchange, because I think anybody listening knows that at some point in time, assets, debts, all have to be exposed and dealt with. So are the disclosures already exchanged before the first group session?
I think it depends on how people want to structure it. I mean, it's up to the professionals that are involved. The ones that I've been involved with, the disclosures are done prior to any meetings, because if you're going to be divvying up assets and debts and figuring out support, you need the information, you need the data. You can't really move forward without it. But I'm glad, I also wanted to respond about how I deal as a therapist with helping people prepare for the legal divorce. So in addition to providing them with all of the different options that Kathy outlined so nicely, I will direct them to the legal information that's available on the court websites that explain the different processes, because it's legal information, it's not advice, it's widely available to people, so that they can get an overview of what has to happen, which is if there are children involved, there has to be a parenting plan, there has to be child support, assets and debts have to be divided. There's a discussion also about the difference between community and separate property. And so people can get that information very early on before they may even, you know, begin consulting with a mediator or attorneys, whether they're going to be collaborative attorneys or, you know, regular litigating attorneys.
You know, you are actually really good at using the court website. You more than anybody I know, you are skilled and expert at that. And you always talk about the value the court website has to the user. And so that's nice. You've kind of trained me that way too. And I appreciate it because it is chock full of information. Yeah. Michelle, what about you?
I was thinking about your question, Judy, about how do you prepare. As a therapist, oftentimes I am confronted with the couple who doesn't know whether they want to go down the divorce path or not. So there's a type of therapy out there called discernment therapy. And just broadly, it is, you know, you present to the couple, here's three choices. You stay married and things stay exactly the way they are and there'll be no change. So that they understand if they do nothing, that'll be the change. Number two would be move towards separation or divorce, in which we would refer to a mediator or any one of the plethora of resources out there to start learning about it. Or number three, which is, you know, my meat and potatoes, is working on reconciling, committing an all-out effort for X amount of time, whatever the couple and I decide on, you know, 3 months, 6 months, and really get into some deep therapeutic work and see if anything is salvageable. I think that just helps them to organize their thoughts in terms of just what path they want to take. So that's where it begins for me.
Thank you, Michelle. And then Marvin, you're not a therapist, but I know that you are really good at interviewing people before you each decide to work with each other. So what do you do if you're not convinced as a mediator that it's time for the couple to start the process? You know what? Your microphone's not working. Or he doesn't want us to hear him. It's one of the two. Marvin's sneaky.
Sorry about that.
Oh, here he's back.
I just encountered this yesterday, as a matter of fact. And I left the couple thinking about discernment counseling, which Michelle just explained very well. And so I'm waiting to hear back from them to see how they want to proceed, if they would like to actually try discernment counseling, or whether they would actually like to move forward with the divorce. Because in speaking with them, the wife seemingly just did not want to even consider staying together, but the husband actually, going against what the wife is telling me, is actually willing to consider staying together. So I brought this up to them and I left it with them, and she was kind of surprised that he would actually be considering that. So I'm waiting to see how it's going to go. I'm really interested to see what they're going to decide.
You know, there was one couple that came to me years ago, and they were just so nice to one another. And I don't really evaluate one way or the other. I just go with the flow, and I service them if they, you know, they want to begin the process. But we started the meeting. We put the petition set together. I gave them an outline of everything coming up so that they would not be operating in the dark. And they called me the next day. They said, it's way too much work. We're going to stay married. That was it.
I love it.
I appreciated them. I really did. Okay. So one of the calls I get is, we want to be divorced by a mediator. And I love hearing that. Then I explain, well, unless a mediator is also licensed to file in court, you know, this is what mediation is. It's a negotiation and a conversation about how you want to move forward, dividing the estate, etc. And then I file for them separately. But all of you mediate. What are your greatest challenges in a mediation in order to make it productive? Go ahead, Victoria.
Those pesky financial disclosures.
Elaborate, please.
Well, in order, the way that I proceed, I know that there are some mediators that sort of want to get like a general idea about what people are interested in doing. You know, will you be asking for spousal support? Will you not? Are you going to be asking for guideline or not? I really prefer to have the financial disclosures done before we begin any of the negotiations. But people are resistant. And, you know, as much as I try to prepare them and explain, yes, it's a lot like doing your taxes, which is really no fun, I know, but you're going to need to get these things done. And I use something called family law software, which is a program that allows people to go in and enter their own data about income and expenses and their assets and debts, which gives them a lot more control. And I do it also because I believe it can lower their costs if they're effective. The resistance to getting this stuff done is unbelievable. And I'm working with a couple right now. They want to start talking about the stuff that is meaningful to them at this juncture, which is about they have four children, but the remaining one, where she's going to go to school and all that kind of thing. And I'm happy to talk to them about that. But they are struggling to get their financial disclosures done. And I really believe that it's not going to be as effective and smooth if they can't do that quickly. And it's really hard to get people to understand that it costs them more money all the time that they are waiting to get that stuff done.
I couldn't agree with you more. The financial disclosures are the bane of my existence. And if it's just running and running and running after people. I think they just don't like paperwork. So the great comparison to taxes, I love that. I think also sometimes if they don't have a lot, they don't like to put their life on paper, or even forget that part, it's your life on paper. What do you think about that as being a resistance? Anybody? Kath?
Well, I think another component to this is that every step they take makes it more real. And they're going through loss and grief and disappointment and fear. So every step they take, it's like, oh my God, this is really happening. Okay, now we're going to fill this form out. Oh my God, this is really happening. So that's a big component, I think.
That's an excellent point. That is. Marvin, how about you?
I think as daunting as the disclosures are for most people, and I struggle with it too, getting people to complete them. And I too, like Victoria, don't like to start negotiating before they're completed, but sometimes I just have to because they haven't done it. But even more challenging for me is couples' unwillingness or inability to let go of the little hurts and the little transgressions that they perceive the other has done against them over the years, so that they can actually get something done. They become so engrossed in the sniping and the, even when they're negotiating seemingly in good faith, they make a little comment, a little dig here and there that kind of upsets the cart, so to speak, as far as the fruitful discussions are concerned. That to me is more challenging than the disclosures.
How do you get them to let go of the past? How do you get them to live in the present as much as possible?
Well, just keep reminding them over and over that they need to let go. And sometimes that works. Sometimes they never do. And sometimes we end up and they're still doing the same thing. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But what I found is I just have to keep saying it over and over.
Kathy?
My approach at being a therapist is to understand the client's family system and the why of their behaviors. So it's important for me it helps me to address their emotions first, and it gives them insight as to what's happening. So my approach is to understand the family system. So when I work with individuals or couples, I like to initially see each person separately for 2 hours. In the first hour, I just let them tell their story and just listen, because I want them to feel completely heard. Even though they talk to their neighbors and their family and their best friends, everybody's always giving them advice, and they don't really feel heard. And the people that give them advice, they're usually coming from a place of what they think they would do in a divorce. So it's completely different. And in the second hour, I have a large tablet, and together we draw their family tree. And I go back 3 generations, and we look at this from a position of understanding, not blame or criticism. So together we start to see the patterns of behavior that get passed on down through the generations. And once they have insight, they then have choice. But if they don't know why they're doing what they're doing, it just keeps being repeated over and over again. Like I have a client, he's on his fourth wife, same personality, same type of woman where she yells and screams, throws furniture all over the place, storms out the front door, and he says, are all women like this? So he really is just beginning to see how this is so related to his mother, that this is what he grew up with. And so he was unconsciously drawn to what was familiar, thinking the internal child thinks that this time I'm going to get it right. This time I'm going to get it right. And they don't realize that they get caught in the same whirlpool.
When you introduced me to the family tree concept, it was, first of all, it allowed me, and I'm not a therapist, so you know I can only go so far when I'm dealing with people's emotions. But first of all, it allowed me to see that it was a pattern. Also, I would just ask people one little question. You know, if I'm listening to somebody talk about the ills of their soon-to-be ex-spouse, I would just ask a little question because you kind of taught me that, and just say, well, what type of a family environment did your spouse grow up in? Just simply that question. It's a light bulb that goes on with people, and they start connecting. Oh my gosh, that's true. Because we all know that we can repeat the behavior of our parents, right? I think most of us know that. Of course, we don't think we are. But that was really enlightening. Michelle, I know that you're just embarking on mediation, but you do couples therapy, right?
That's right.
So what's the hardest part for you to work with in couples therapy, especially if you know that more than likely they may end up in divorce?
Yeah, it's really challenging because my heart is in it to help them reconcile. I can almost always see where their fight cycle is and how they are so stuck. So I really, personally tried to fight for them to be together because I do believe you can conquer. But like you said, there's just times where one is unwilling, unable, just does not have the capacity to self-reflect and to understand their part in the cycle. So it sort of has to wear its course where we get to a point where everyone's exhausted from trying to make this work and realizing some patterns just will not be broken. So I don't know if that answers your question.
But No, it does. It does. Yeah. Arguing. How do you, Kathy and Victoria, Marvin is, as you could probably tell, Marvin's connection was a little rough and he just lost connection, but I know he'll be back with us soon because he is technologically superior to me. But what do you do, mediators, Kathy and Victoria, when people start arguing in a mediation?
Well, for me, I have a structured process. And so in the beginning, I go through suggested ground rules for mediation, and I have each person say out loud what those ground rules are. And if they have any questions about it, we elaborate a little bit more. So such as, we shall take turns speaking and not interrupt each other. We shall not blame, attack, or engage in put downs. We shall stay away from establishing hard positions. I mean, there's 14 of them. And so it also starts to take away their focus on their anger and focus on the present right now. So it diverts their attention. That's not to say that they're not going to go back to that, but at least we start to say what the ground rules are. And if they go off that, I'll say, remember what we talked about. This is for you to stay focused and future oriented so that you can get this completed in a way with dignity and respect.
So that's all great if they can actually hear. Do you have situations ever, Victoria, where they just aren't even hearing? They're so focused on themselves and the argument. What do you do?
Well, like Kathy, I also do ground rules, and like Kathy, I will remind them that they agreed to they endorsed those answers. So they, were willing to do that, at least when they started. But I also I'm aware that people get flooded. And so I use a therapeutic intervention, which is to reflect and validate I can see how upset you are. I can see this is a very important topic to you. I can see that you are very upset about this. I understand that this harkens back to some other fight that isn't about right what we're dealing with right now. So I use validating techniques. The other thing that sometimes I jump in and I'll go stop, and then and actually being in a Zoom setting is better because I can just keep talking over somebody else that wants to keep talking, and I just keep talking, and so that they can't even hear themselves talking anymore until they finally just give up and get quiet. I've done that.
Wow, that's a new one for me because we're having this discussion when post in the Zoom era.
Yeah, and the other thing sometimes I'll say is, you guys could do this without me here. You can do this without me here, and you're paying me money to do something that you do very well without my assistance. So I will say that. And then finally, what I will do sometimes, if my sense is that they're flooded because they are not feeling heard, is to use a technique called an intentional dialogue, where I ask them to sort of settle in. Sometimes you have to use a grounding technique. Look, let's take maybe a break. Call for a break, Go breathe. Take a walk around the block. If you need to call a trusted advisor to help you do that, go for it, right? But then to come back and to say, look, I just want you guys to see if you can actually hear each other. And then I guide them through an intentional dialogue, which involves a sender and a receiver, a validator, an empathizer, and sometimes you can get them to engage in that, and that can kind of bring down the temperature.
I love
that. Those are some of the techniques that I use when people get flooded and are arguing.
I love those. I love what you just said. I have to think about that and steal from you, of course. Marvin, what do you do when it gets really heated in a mediation?
Well, I try to keep it from getting there in the first place.
How? Please, how do you even keep it from getting there?
Well, actually, what I've found is fairly effective. Is actually similar to what Victoria just described, which is I'll ask them to listen to each other and then tell me or tell each other what they just heard. And then say whether or not they accept that. They don't have to agree. Remind them that they don't have to agree. Ask them, okay, what do you think about that? Is that okay? Do you want to think about it? And what's your proposal? So using Bill Eddy's method of what's your proposal? And that works to actually keep the heat down. Once it gets up there, the most effective thing that I have found is actually taking a break. Just give them time out. And sometimes we have to suspend the session until another day. But once it gets so far up there, you can't do anything because they can't hear. They can't hear you. They don't want to hear. So I just try to keep it from getting there.
I like that you said, I ask them to repeat back what the other person said. Because, it's that game of telephone where we whisper in each other's ear and it comes out a completely different sentence at the end of the line. Because we filter the words coming at us with the prism, I guess, of our own emotions and our own inner dialogue. But that's a great technique to say, well, what did you hear? I've used it a couple times. I don't use it every time. I'm going to have to remember this. Because when they repeat back, they repeat back in two different ways. They repeat back in words and tone of voice. And isn't tone of voice beyond the words sometimes the real message? What do you think?
It is. And sometimes they actually translate when they're giving it back, as far as tone is concerned. And it actually makes them pay more attention also to what's being said. And another thing that happens is that the person who is actually speaking can feel acknowledged because they're actually hearing back what they actually said.
That's great. That's a really
great tool. That's something that people need.
No, you're absolutely right. And just for everybody, Marvin referred to a gentleman named Bill Eddy. Well, Bill Eddy is the international guru of high conflict personalities, how to communicate with them, how to divorce them, how to get along in any way. Bill has two interviews on this podcast, January of 2020, Divorcing a High Conflict Personality and Co-Parenting, or I think it was Co-Parenting with a Narcissist. And I just interviewed him recently, and I'm going to post his new interview, I think Co-Parenting with a High Conflict Personality. So he's great, and he has 25 books. You can get them on Amazon, and I'm really glad you brought his name up, because everybody here is a big fan of using his methods, which is wonderful. Michelle, did you want to add anything? Did I see your hand up?
No, I was just moving my hand. No. I think what everyone just said is absolutely imperative in stopping the arguing, because it's not productive. They can do it at home. So you just remind them of the rules or have them read the rules. When I was in person, I would roll up a little closer to them, you know, just make some contact and really look them in the eye and do the validation that Victoria and Marvin were talking about. And yeah, the reflective listening back and forth. If I understand you, you said X, Y, Z, do I have that right? Whether they agree or not, it's just, do I have it right? Is that what you just said? And that really creates, it slows down the process and it creates more clarity. So what they said is great.
Let's go to mediators and therapists working together, because we talked a lot about this on the panel and we deal with this in our everyday lives. Therapists. Even though Kathy and Victoria both address the collaborative law model, I would say that many mediations are just between the two parties and the mediator without all of the other professionals at the table. Therapists, have you been invited to a more scaled down version of a mediation with just the mediator and the two parties? And how does that happen? How does that transpire? If so, Kath?
Well, Judy, you called me in on a mediation once with a couple who were arguing about parenting styles and what do we do? And the husband was an alcoholic and he was in denial about what was going on. And he was really upset that I have a list of guidelines for addictions and what people can do to help themselves. And some people go with it and some people don't. I can remember being at conciliation court and a couple came in and the wife said, please, he drinks too much and this has got to stop. We've got two kids and he just can't stop. And he sat there and said, he raised up his hand and said, oh my God, there she goes again. I do not drink a lot. I don't. And so I asked him, I said, well, could you share with me what you drink? And he said, yes. He said, I come home, I work hard all day long. I have 2 6-packs of beer. I come home and have a bottle of wine with dinner. And then I have cognac. He was dead serious and then looked at me and said, now tell me, is that a lot? I said, yes, it is a lot.
God.
I'm not kidding you. It's a true story.
You know, you need to live close to the emergency room if that's your habit, because I can't imagine that you're not dead.
Right, right.
But you know what? You brought up a really good point, though, in which I did invite you. You, of course, referred the client to me after you saw them as a couples therapist and I guess realized that divorce was imminent. And so you knew something about them and you referred me as the legal document preparation company who could, excuse me, file for divorce. So in the process of doing that, they wanted to mediate. And because I was told by the wife that there was a substance abuse issue going on and a little bit of background about it, I thought it prudent to invite you as the therapist to give me that extra support as a mediator to guide the discussion emotionally. And then there was a really good point that you had obviously brought up in therapy because they referred to it, and I brought it up in the mediation. So it was two different professionals trying to support them properly, and that was in the co-parenting discussion, and the level of custody, sole versus joint. Leaving the children, two small children, with the substance abused parent on their own and overnight. And what could possibly happen to the children if this parent decided to, you know, drink or take whatever drugs the parent was taking? And Victoria, Marvin, and even Michelle, this is a really serious issue for any of us to deal with if we're doing a co-parenting schedule. And the allegation, where we don't live with them, so we have to just listen to what somebody is saying. And the allegation is serious substance abuse, cannot let the kids be with him or her overnight. Victoria, what do you do?
I think it's a really difficult question. I think you could almost devote an entire podcast to the question of how do you manage conversations about addiction and mediation? Because mediators are not fact finders. Mediators are not advocates, except for the process, right? I mean, that's what we're all trained as mediators. We advocate for our process. But, you know, it is he said, she said. You know, we're not going out and following somebody to see what they're actually doing. And, you know, when there are allegations and there hasn't been, a DUI, there hasn't been anything that would give, you know, evidence that could be used to substantiate or corroborate a claim of substance abuse, it's very tricky for mediators. And then the only thing that I can do in that moment is to say, look, I am not God. I can't see what's going on when you guys aren't here, but I'm here to offer you a process that allows you to address the concerns that are important to you. And if your spouse is worried about your consumption of whatever it is, that's the person that you're going to have to deal with. And so you guys are going to have to come up with a way of making an agreement that is going to honor all of the concerns. And, you know, I've had people that want to put the BAC levels in their stipulated judgment to say, you know, well, if they ever get any, you know, higher than this amount, then that means an automatic change of custody. They figure it out. They actually, you know, the breathalyzers, they are aware of all of the different things and they do figure it out. But I have to be very clear that I am not there to say, if there isn't a DUI, if there isn't something like that, to say, I don't know what's going on and I don't need to in order to help the two of you to figure this out. Now, if there's a DUI, if there are other, you know, pieces of evidence, real evidence,
right,
then it is a different kind of conversation. But it goes differently because, you know, the person can't say, well, I didn't have a DUI.
Right. Right.
So anyway, that's my two cents on it.
Do you ever, Victoria, go as far as talking about the risk involved if the non-addictive parent allows the children to be alone with the alleged addicted parent and something happens with then DFS, Child Protective Services, coming in and literally removing the children from the house, period, for a while until things can be sorted out on a different level of the law? Do you ever go there with that?
If there is some corroborating evidence that isn't just the parties saying what they're saying about each other, then absolutely, that's important information, you know? And I prefer to provide outside sources. So I would say, you know, this is a concern. Go talk to, you know, a therapist about, you know, mandated reporting. You know, one of the things that is child neglect is to allow your child to be present if there's domestic violence. That this can be a problem. Same thing if you permit your child to be with someone that you know is not sober. But doing it if there's not in the absence of something that lets you say, okay, look, this is clearly a problem, I think as a mediator you have to be very careful about not just assuming that because somebody says it's so, it's so.
Those are really, really, really good points. How about in terms of one of the support services that you would refer, an attorney who could start just laying out the law around this type of situation if there was extreme, excuse me, substance abuse and something happened to the children on the watch of that parent? Maybe an attorney could be the one that just lays all of that out and then gets the mediator off the hook.
Yeah, well, and you know, I mean, in my confidentiality agreement, there are paragraphs about consulting attorneys. I request that everybody disclose if they're going to use consulting attorneys at the very beginning, so there's no secrets about it. I, of course, offer up my consulting attorney list, all of whom are usually trained as mediators or collaboratively. I'm not going to send somebody to someone who has a reputation as being a litigating family lawyer.
So, for obvious reasons. Yeah,
the idea of bringing in a consulting attorney is really helpful.
Marvin, how about you? What do you do in a case where you have this situation in a mediation? How do you handle it?
Well, it's interesting you should ask that. I recently have helped a couple through that very scenario recently. One of them, the husband, has a history of drug abuse, alcohol abuse. He's trying to get his act together. He's been through therapy and has gone through a drying out process. And is willing to actually be monitored. And the wife is very concerned that he actually sticks to his goal and what he says he's going to do, which is to abstain from abusing alcohol and drugs. And actually, we've actually set up, he actually joined a service that actually would monitor him as far as alcohol is concerned. And he's actually willing to purchase another system for drugs, for marijuana specifically, so that he can take random tests. So he's very motivated. He has shown that he is willing to put forth the work and the inconvenience and actually realistically withstand the lack of trust. Until he can gain that trust again with his spouse or soon to be former spouse, so it's a real problem. And you know, I deal with this a lot because I mediate in the dependency court, which is what you alluded to a little while ago, which actually handles cases where parents have not taken great care of their kids or you know, abuse alcohol, abuse drugs. Domestic violence, all sorts of things that are dangerous for their children. And I help people when they're coming out of that process to actually set up parenting plans. And those are real concerns that one parent will actually put their children in a very dangerous situation. There's nothing that we as mediators can do about that. About all we can do is remind them of their responsibility that they have to their children. Sometimes that works. I know that it probably doesn't work all the time, but that's what I try to do. I try to remind them of their responsibility to their children, because realistically, there's no way to check up on them. You know, an attorney can clarify what would happen if perhaps, you know, things are wrong, but people are going to do what they're going to do. And in my point of view, it's best to simply encourage them to do what they know they should be doing for their children, because they're their responsibility.
You know, that was a very enlightened father that you just described. That warms my heart to hear that somebody is that responsible and really cares. And I have found that a couple times, but it's, you know, not typically, but quite often, it'll be, there's nothing wrong with me. I can handle things on my own. I can quit if I want, and I don't need anybody in charge of me. I can make my own decisions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, until somebody really understands the significance of their behavior and the damage it can potentially do. I mean, look, people have pool parties at their homes. There's, you know, everybody's doing fine. Somebody, little chub may almost drown in the pool because your focus is off them for a minute. I mean, it's so unbelievably easy to not be right there, you know, when your child needs you. And I don't know, I just, that to me is quite surprising. But when you're addicted, there's all this denial until you're ready to acknowledge and then take the steps you need to take care of yourself. Michelle, when you're dealing with couples and there's a substance abuse issue with one parent, how do you handle it? What's your approach?
Yeah, well, you know, substance abuse tends to be contraindicated for couples therapy. So meaning it's not advisable if one is actively using and in the throes of an addiction, it's probably best that they get treatment and go get themselves sober to figure out what's going on there, because the addiction is too much of a distractor, if you will, from couples counseling. That said, they do come in, right? You're not, you know, sometimes you don't find out until four sessions into it, right? So it's not a, you know, black and white situation, but it is challenging because you have to just bring it into their cycle. So, you know, when this happens, you go and you go have a drink. And then when you drink, it has this effect on your partner. And then your partner does this. So we just tie it in to help them see how it is contributing and how it's creating the dynamic between them. So it just becomes, you know, part of the discussion. But certainly if one person is heavily in the throes of an addiction, I'm going to encourage them to make that their priority before trying to fix the marriage. I mean, it happens simultaneously, but they've got to be willing. If they're in denial, we can't work together.
You know, thank you for that. And Kathy and Victoria, so do you pause when you see that there is this impediment? We'll just use substance abuse as the impediment. Do you pause your mediations or your therapy sessions? So that they can regroup maybe and think about how they want to proceed with their own lives and then with therapy or mediation?
Yeah, everybody's different. However, if somebody's really in denial, sometimes I'll separate them and I'll say in this particular case, I'll talk to the man and he'll say, no, I'm not drinking. No, I'm not doing this. Or else they'll say, yes, I am drinking. And I'll say, you know what? I said, I'm wondering if all of this alcohol is trying to soothe the inner pain that's inside you.
You go right for it, because that's right, what it is, right. Isn't it?
It really is about the pain that they're trying to soothe. But it does, at first, it's like it was their friend because it numbs them. And then overall, it becomes their enemy because it begins to destroy them. Yeah. And then I'll encourage them to get into a treatment program. I'll encourage them to be sent to an interventionist. There's a man named Ed Storty, and he's done wonders with some of my clients. And he's just great. And he's a former alcoholic himself.
And he's in Los Angeles, right?
He's in Los Angeles, yeah. And he has a team of people. But he saved somebody's life. This man was really on the edge of near death. And I said, would you please do this? And his wife said, please do this, please. So he finally said, okay. And it really turned his life around. So there's a way to do it, but I think that they have to come in contact with their pain and their loss. And usually it's passed on down through the generations. You can look at the grandparents, alcoholics. You can look at their parents, alcoholics. And here he is doing it again. You know, so, and I don't blame people. It's how do we understand it? And are they willing to move forward?
You know what? Good point. And I'd like to make this point to everybody listening. There is no blame. You know, with anybody in our profession, there is no blame. There's just the intention to provide your service to help in the best way we can. And you so nailed it on that. Did you want to add anything to that, Victoria?
I just was thinking about, you know, the model that I was trained in when I was actually in graduate school was motivational interviewing. And sometimes it's really helpful if you're talking to people where there is still denial to kind of locate them on the, you know, are they in pre-contemplation? Are they in contemplation? Are they in decision? Are they in action? Are they in maintenance? Are they in relapse? You know, where are they in this sort of circle of places that somebody who's struggling with a substance abuse issue is? And sometimes, you know, you can sort of say, well, it sounds like you don't really think you have a problem. And so you would be, and I do a little psychoed, you know, I say, look, you know, this is a model that's used a lot and it sounds like you're in pre-contemplation right now. You're thinking you don't really quite have a problem. And then, you know, maybe I would do an intervention like Michelle suggested, which has to do with saying, well, let's look at the dynamic, the relational piece here. What happens to the relationship, you know? And one of the actual DSM, you know, criteria for any kind of actual disorder is impairment in relationships, impairment in function, right? So if somebody is able to share, you know, well, I don't really think it's a problem, but my significant other does, well, that's actually one of the criteria for a substance abuse problem. So anyway, I think that it's an art, you know, these interventions, whether you're going to work with people who are struggling with substance abuse, either individually or as a couple, are, you know, very kind of individual decisions for clinicians.
Absolutely. Yeah. I want to finish with one other example that each and every one of us deals with, whether it's in therapy or mediation, and it certainly comes up in mediation. And that is, there's an infant up to 1 year old, maybe a little over one, and there's a divorce, and the mother doesn't believe, feel, or think that the child should spend overnights with dad for like 18 years. No, I'm kidding. But for, you know, maybe 3 years. How do you handle this? Because there's all these the abandoned, no, the attachment theory that the mothers bring in. I believe in attachment theory. Child is attached to me. Done. How do you all handle this discussion? Marvin, why don't you start?
That's interesting you should ask that. I actually have not actually encountered that where the mother was unwilling to let the father have overnights with a young child like that. I have dealt with a situation where the question has come up, but they were able to work through it, and he was able to give her reassurances, and I was able to help with referring them to some therapeutic information regarding, you know, the development of however young they are, and just help them work through it. But I haven't encountered this situation where the mother absolutely just denied the right or that it was a good idea for the father to have the child overnight. That there are perhaps some challenges that they face when that is the case, but usually parents can work that out.
Kathy, how about you?
I have had I had a couple where they came in, but they were sent by their lawyers, and he actually smelled of beer when he came into my office. And she says, I'm not going to allow an infant to go and be with him because he doesn't know what he's doing. And I don't know if he's going to drink more or less. And what happens? Is he going to forget to change the baby? Is he going to forget to feed the baby? And they got into a great big fight. And they just couldn't agree on anything, and I sent them back to their attorneys.
Well, what about if there's no substance abuse? It's just the idea and the position of mom that a child should only be with mom for the first 2 or 3 years of her life in terms of overnights.
Well, I just had a case like that. The mother says they have a baby who's 8 months old, and the mother said, I'm willing to have him have overnights when my son is 10 years old and he says, I want to spend the night with dad. I'm not kidding you. And he should not be with his father. He should be with me all the time. And she said, you're only here because our lawyer sent us here, but he shouldn't be with his father. So I explained the whole thing about children need to have the right to see both parents and to love both parents, that he's going to learn good things from his father and good things from the mother. And she was just entrenched in her position. And if ever I supported the father in the least little bit of way, see, you're on his side, you're not on my side at all. And what she really wanted was to stay in the court system and have a judge say it. So they did go to court. And the judge did order a step-up plan. She wouldn't hear a step-up plan from me. But she did, because the judge says, okay, for the next 2 weeks, this is going to happen. For the 2 weeks after that, this is what's going to happen. And she was furious. She had to hand over the baby in the courtroom to the father for his time. And she was just beside herself. So this, I mean, there's lots of layers to this case. But true story. When he was 10 years old, he could then have overnights.
It's making me smile, Victoria.
So, you know, this question about overnights is one that is so hotly debated. Like, if you go to AFCC meetings, like there was an entire, I think, AFCC meeting in Chicago that was about this very issue.
What is AFCC?
Association of Family and Conciliation Courts.
Okay.
And, you know, it's really a cool organization. It's full of lawyers and therapists and mediators and judges. You know, well, most custody evaluators are mental health professionals, but, you know, it's an organization of all of these different folks. But this is an issue that is primal for people. And even within these communities of people who are trying to help the couples manage it, it touches on so many very primitive feelings for people. And there's, you know, and then they want to use the social science research to support particular positions. So they have, you know, the research from Alan Shore, who is this, you know, psychologist at UCLA that is really all about, you know, right brain to right brain attunement, and that only mothers really do this well. And then you've got a whole group of other researchers that are talking about the fact that, you know, any research that shows that men are very capable of bonding with babies and caring for them. But anyway, so, you know, the AFCC is interested in social science research, but there is no consensus among social scientists, among even the people that are looking at, you know, the interpersonal neurobiology stuff about what is going to be good for these babies in the long run. So it's sort of a hotbed of controversy. And ultimately, you know, Kathy's example, I think, is really important to be able to tell our mediation clients about, to say, look, I want you to be able to understand what's going to happen if you go to court and you're no longer in charge of this decision. At least in one case, this is what the judge did. So do you want the judge to do it, or do you want to do it?
And Kathy, in your example, did that mom think the judge was going to think like her?
Yes, she thinks everybody's going to think like her.
Ah. And so it was quite a shock when that happened.
Oh, stunned. And even when we came back to finish some of the other topics, I want to go to court.
I do find it interesting that people think the judge is going to think like them. And I always explain, no two judges rule the same. There is a lane that they have to work in. And Victoria, years ago, gave me the guidebooks that give the options in each point of law in which the judges have to rule. And I found that amazing. So, okay, there is a roadmap, so to speak, that the judges can look at. Maybe they have a few little forks and bends, but they all stay within the same lane. I thought that was extremely valuable.
Yeah, the judicial bench books, which are available online, again, legal information, anybody can get it, are incredibly helpful sometimes. When people are fighting about certain issues, you can say, okay, well, let's just look and see what the judges are are trained to do in this particular scenario. And there's a bench book for, you know, custody and visitation. There's a bench book for division of assets and debts. There's a bench book for support issues. And you can do a literal control F search to find your search terms, and you can pull them up and you can show them to people. I do. And, you know, with spouse support issues, I pull up the family code section and I take them through every single one and say, where do you think you're going to fall on this? I mean, I really, and part of that is because I really respect people's intelligence. I really believe that people are intelligent enough. Now, if they're flooded, you know, we're all apes when we're flooded, right? You know,
true.
But you know, when people are calm, they're smart. And they are intelligent, and they can, and if you give them information and engage them, they can respond to that. And I think they appreciate it, that they appreciate being kind of encouraged to take control of their lives and to be thoughtful and to look at what the system is going to offer them and make decisions that are going to work for them and their families ultimately.
That's a beautiful statement. That really is. Thank you. I love that you said that. Michelle, do you ever do anything with parenting plans in your practice at all yet?
Not yet, but what I recently did have a couple, and they were working out just this very issue, and the mom was breastfeeding, so the father was more in line with allowing the baby to stay overnight, you know, completely at mom's until the baby was weaned, and that provided, you know, the more flexibility, even though she could pump and he could do bottles. So, you know, it is case by case, and each case has to really understand the needs of the baby, the needs of the family. And in that situation, it worked out well. And now the baby is a little over one, and they are doing overnights, and it's going fine. So if you have two reasonable people who can look for what's best for the baby, and the father spent time during the day quite a bit with the child. So got to hopefully find a reasonable response, reasonable decision each, between them.
Each one of you kind of referenced something that I'd like to end with, and the option, and that is the option of a step-up plan, which I think opens the door for great hope and great creativity, and it doesn't make dad feel frozen out for an undetermined amount of time. So can you all please address the step-up plan? Marvin, why don't you start?
Okay. Are you speaking specifically about that particular situation?
Right. Well, we're talking about an infant or a very young child, and mom is really reluctant to release the child for overnights, and breastfeeding may be part of it.
Right. It may be. And sometimes they are unwilling, the mother is unwilling to actually pump milk and give it to the father for that purpose, simply because she doesn't feel that it's appropriate anyway for him to have the child overnight. And I did say that usually people can work through it, but usually that's what helps them work through it, is some sort of step-up plan and encouragement, referencing what the court might do if they don't put together a plan of their own, that the court will actually make a step-up plan for them. And so that's very, let's say, influential to parents. When they're thinking about it, when they're trying to work through this. But the step-up plan is, the key to the step-up plan is that it has to be, there have to be definite steps that they follow. So it can't be, well, whenever the child stops breastfeeding, well, some children stop breastfeeding at 6 months, some at 2 years, some at 3 years. I've heard of cases where they were breastfeeding when they were five or six. So you don't want to leave. You don't want to leave it like that, in that sort of limbo. You want to. It has to be specific. In okay, well, after 3 weeks, a month, 3 months, whatever the time period is that they can agree on, then we will move to this time with dad, and maybe overnights, or maybe when the child is 3 months old, or 4 months old, or 6 months old, whatever they can work out amongst themselves. But it has to be some definite time period or some specific thing that will trigger the next step in the plan.
Kathy, how about you?
I have a couple right now that I'm working with, and they have like 5 kids and of different ages. And the father, well, it's a long story, but anyway, he kept saying, I'm not going to be able to see my kids. I'm not going to be able to see my kids. And the wife was saying, you know, they're used to being with me. They're used to being with me. And so that we created a plan. Finally, we created a plan, but it was so detailed. It was something they couldn't possibly follow. It was so much exchange back and forth. It would have been too trying on the kids, but they were convinced this was going to work. So I left it alone. I said, you know what, let's try this for a while. Let's see how it works for you. Let's see how it works for the kids. And within 7 days, they called me back and said, we can't do this. This is crazy. But you know what? This is how we all learn. We have to try things and see, does it work for us? So, you know, they had to make their own choice. Yeah. So now they're saying that they want a 2-2-5, and great. Let's try that. Let's see how it works for them. Let's see how it works for the kids.
Right, right. Okay. And Victoria, anything to add to that?
I wanted to emphasize the idea that there should be something that allows people to know what is going to trigger the next step up. And it doesn't have to be time. I mean, Marvin already said this, but I just want to really emphasize it. You know, it could be something like, you know, the child is sleeping through the night, or, you know, the weaning part, like Marvin said, you know, they're the people, you know, when the baby is weaned, provided that it's before they turn 3 or whatever it is. You know, but I think it's really important for people to be engaged in creating those conditions for themselves that will trigger the next step up. And I also really love what Kathy said. Sometimes it's really, and it is part of being respectful, I think, again, let people try things. Right? Give them the opportunity to experiment, explore. It's okay if it doesn't work out. You're learning, it's all information. You've never done this before. You've never been divorced before. You don't know. Your kids haven't, you know, it's okay. You can experiment. And the thing about mediation is that you can do that. You don't have to have, you know, the order that is with the court, and then you're in violation of the order, and then God knows what's going to happen to you, right?
Right. True.
Well, I really love that Kathy said that, and think that's a really important thing to give people.
Yes, and in a step-up plan, meaning it's one schedule now, and then whatever the trigger will be for a new version of the parenting plan, and then beyond that, there may be a third version. You know, maybe it's 3 tiers and not 2 tiers. What I tell all of my clients is, you know, what you're doing, even if there's no issue with how time and is divided and overnight, whatever you're doing now to put in the settlement agreement is now. It's going to change. Life changes. The kids' needs change. Everybody's schedules change. And so just be ready to be flexible with one another. Additional to that, in these step-up plans, you know, typically it's dad waiting to be let into the overnight schedule. You know, this gives dad time to get his home fixed for the child, learn from mom, you know, the foods to eat. So dad can use this as a very educational time, right? And provide to mom the comfort that when it's time to go to that next step, dad is set and ready to go. What do you all think about that? Yeah. So, okay, we're at the end of the time, and it went really fast for me. This was such a great discussion, and always, because I love all of you. I would like people to be able to get in touch with you. I'm going to start with Marvin. If somebody wants to talk with you about mediation, because that's the one area you work in now, you're not filing anymore, right?
That's correct.
So how would people get in touch with you, Marvin?
They can go to my website, whistlermediate.com. They can send me an email at mwhistlerdm@gmail.com, or they can call me at 424-249-7686.
Say the number once again.
424-249-7686.
And unfortunately, because your mic was cutting out, you're going to see this in the show notes, everybody, when you're listening to the episode, but you can even just Google Marvin Whistler and you'll get in touch with him. We'll go around the table. Kathy, how about you? How do we even get in touch with you?
They can just type in Kathy Memel and it'll lead them to my website. And my telephone number, I have an office in Beverly Hills, and that telephone number is 310-286-9201. And my email is info@drkathymemel.com.
Excellent. Michelle?
You can just go to my website. It's called Talk to Michelle. Michelle only has one L, TalkToMichelle.com.
Thank you, Michelle and Victoria. How do they get in touch with you?
You can Google my name and you'll find my website and there's a contact form there. Or you can email me at vgoldfarb@hushmail.com. Or you can call me 310-339-4598.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the time you've all taken, and hopefully we can do this again in the future. I also appreciate all of you for listening. I hope you found this informative and useful. Please pass this podcast on to your friends. Please send me any suggestions for episodes or questions you may have. I'm going to start reading them in some episodes. You can reach me through my website for the podcast, theamicabledivorceexpert.com. And you know, as always, have an amicable day.
That's our show for today. Thank you for joining us. Be good to yourselves, be kind to your spouse, and cherish your children above all else.